Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Southern Louisiana, underwater again. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Massive flooding that began last week near Baton Rouge is now being compared to Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans in 2005. The Red Cross calls this America's worst natural disaster since Superstorm Sandy hit New Jersey 4 years ago. This time there was no advance warning, but the victims are in for long-term suffering, especially low-income people in vulnerable neighborhoods. Along with multiple fires in California after years of drought, it's one of many signals we're already living with climate change from global warming. Today's talking point, Uber and driverless cars in Pittsburgh. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. The storm that snuck up on southern Louisiana starting last week still has no name, but tens of thousands of people will be living with the damage for a long time to come. We'll hear what they've been through and what they're in for from another message about global warming. Today's talking point, watch out Google, Apple, Tesla, and Ford, Uber wants to be first with a self-driving car. This month, you'll be able to order one up on your smartphone in Pittsburgh. First, as news update, Donald Trump is in Louisiana today, surveying flood damage and handing out supplies. But the political press is focused on changes in his campaign leadership. Paul Manafort has resigned just days after Stephen Bannon, the chair of the right-wing website Breitbart News, came on board. Rebecca Sinderbrand is deputy national political editor at the Washington Post. Always good to hear from you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Trump's son Eric says that Manafort was a distraction, apparently because of his ties to Russia and Ukraine. What do we expect from Breitbart, from Bannon?
Sure. Well, you know, it wasn't just, of course, the ties to Ukraine, which were very much a part of this, but there was also the fact that you look over the past few weeks and Donald Trump's poll numbers have been taking a hit. And he felt like he needed a change, and he brought in new people to kind of lead the way. Now, as you mentioned, that head of Breitbart News, Steve Bannon, is one of those people. Steve Bannon is someone who very much reflects Trump's sensibility. He's someone who has been echoing many of the messages that Trump has given through the Breitbart News site. Kellyanne Conway, the other person involved, is very much a political strategist who's a veteran and a professional and maybe represents a little bit of a kinder, gentler edge in that she wants to help Trump package his views to help it then appeal to people who are not already core supporters. But those are the two directions that the campaign is heading in at this moment.
Now, there's been a lot of speculation that Bannon would encourage the candidate to be more derisive and more strident than ever, but Trump sounded almost apologetic last night in North Carolina.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that.
He got a lot of applause.
And believe it or not, I regret it.
Rebecca Sinderbrand, back to you. He has said he would never say that he regretted anything.
That's absolutely right. But of course, you'll note two things there. Number one, he did not say precisely what it is that he regretted. That seemed like very much a blanket statement, but it didn't necessarily say, in this situation, I wish that I had not said these things. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not we get more details about precisely what it is that Donald Trump regrets. It's also worth noting that we've seen, perhaps not necessarily this dramatically, but we've seen him make moves in this vein before, where he seems to be introducing perhaps a persona with less of an edge, making an outreach, reaching out to people who may support his message but have not been thrilled with the way in which he's delivered it. But of course, in times past, he's always reversed himself and reverted to kind of his usual method of communication very quickly. So we'll have to see exactly how long this tone lasts.
You said that Stephen Bannon of Breitbart News reflects Trump's sensibility, but he also, Bannon, at Breitbart, speaks pretty much to the alt-right movement, which features white nationalism and anti-Semitism. Are we going to see that in the campaign?
You know, Breitbart is a very, very controversial organization, obviously. And Donald Trump has had many of the questions swirling around his campaign that Breitbart has had swirling around itself about whether or not the people who are fans are people who reflect their values or don't reflect their values. You know, it's a balancing act for Donald Trump right now in that he needs to hold on to these core supporters, obviously. He cannot afford to slip below the level that he's had, what we've assumed to be his floor. He's gone below it a bit this month. On the other hand, he has to, at this point, begin to pull back some of the people who he may have lost over the past few weeks with kind of his dramatic statements, in particular the period immediately following the conventions. And so that's why you heard what you heard last night. And he has to, again, hold on to the core supporters and reach out to people who may have been wavering.
Bannon doesn't have any experience in political campaigns. Kellyanne Conway, the other person who came on board, really does. She is a pro. We now are beginning to see TV spots for Trump.
That's right. I mean, of course, those have been in the works for a little bit. This is, interestingly enough, and this is a first for us, it's more than halfway through the general election season, and we are seeing the first Donald Trump general election campaign ads. Kellyanne Conway, as you mentioned, is very much a professional, and she's someone who has been on TV throughout the primary season, almost diagnosing the problems with Donald Trump's campaign and offering suggestions for ways that he might change his tone and alter his strategy. These new ads that came out today, it's, again, interesting, circling back to what we were just saying. These are spots that seem to very much speak to his core supporters, the issues that they care about, the issues that animate them, not necessarily positions that resonate, for instance, with swing voters, if there are any swing voters left out there, independent voters, more moderate voters. So that's the gamble that they're taking with this first round of television spots.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Cinderbrand, again, Deputy National Political Editor at The Washington Post. In a moment, Southern Louisiana, underwater again on To the Point from PRI.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. It wasn't predicted, and it wasn't suddenly dramatic like a tropical storm. Starting last Thursday, southern Louisiana was hit by a massive, slow-moving disaster.
Walls of water coming down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Authorities tonight saying the flood damage is now the worst natural disaster to hit the U.S. since Superstorm Sandy.
You're okay.
Louisiana's governor has declared a state of emergency.
Just a couple hours, we probably had 6 foot of water.
We're coming, we're coming. I'm gonna break this window. We're breaking the window.
30-inch rainfall totals. Louisiana has gotten punched in the gut.
In Livingston Parish near Baton Rouge, 75% of the homes have been destroyed. Some 70,000 people have already registered for assistance. President Obama declared a national disaster on Sunday, and the damage is estimated at $1 billion at least. David Mitchell is a reporter for the Advocate News in Baton Rouge, and he joins us from Ascension Parish. David, good to have you on our program.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
How bad is the damage there? What do you see when you look around?
It's pretty bad. We just got an estimate from the parish folks here, the county government folks, that the damaged houses and businesses is now up to 19,000 just in Ascension Parish. Pretty much anywhere you drive outside of one of our main towns, Gonzales, outside that area, Sorrento, Santa Mall, which you've probably seen in the news a lot, a place called Galvez, all these places have had lots and lots of water, several feet. Lots of the public officials who are responding to this event, their houses have flooded. The former chairman of the person who was in charge of drainage for this area, his house had flooding to the roof. Not for lack of effort, this is just an overwhelming storm that basically blew the doors off of everything that they had in place.
A flood to the roof, that says everything, I think, all at once. Obviously, people moving around in boats. What do they say? What are people telling you about this? Did they expect it? Were they warned in advance?
I think it kind of caught people by surprise a little bit. You know, we're used to hurricanes. This is hurricane season right now. We're almost in the prime of hurricane season. You might note that this is a couple weeks from when Katrina hit, Rita hit, some of these other big storms we've had in the last year. So this is the time when people are thinking about hurricanes, but this wasn't a hurricane. It didn't have the cachet of a name, Juan or Katrina or Rita or Gustav or something. It'll strike a little fear in you. It was nothing like that. It's just, hey, there's a bad storm coming, and they were kind of warning people, you know, this is going to be a really severe storm. You need to prepare. So it was kind of seeping in, I would say, but I don't think anybody realized the magnitude of what was coming.
David Mitchell, again with the Advocate News in Baton Rouge. We'll come back to you as we go on with our program, but I want to introduce Paul Champagne. He's a resident of Baton Rouge, and Paul Champagne, it's great to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you were okay because you live on a hill. What do you see when you look around?
Well, it wasn't really a hill. It's more of just our neighborhood development is just a few feet higher than the flood level, so we were pretty safe.
But you're an island,
we were safe,
I understand.
The roads around here are lower, so when the water started rising, we were limited to our access, so we bailed out pretty early.
So you were able to get out. What about your mom?
My mom was able to get out, but she, her and her niece left. They left with water in the house, so they just took the car and headed out of town.
And what happened to the house?
The house got over 2 feet of water in it.
So how long is it going to be, do you think, before she can go back, or has she already gone back? And what's it going to take to fix the house?
Well, we've already gone back. We've already gutted the whole house. So everything 4 foot along the walls, everything 4 foot and down is stripped down to just the studs. All the furniture was ruined. Everything that touched the ground is ruined. We've got a pile of trash, you know, from one side of the property to the other side of the property, and it's probably 10 feet high. It's just everything that you own.
Did she have flood insurance?
No, she was never required. I'm not required. Most people in Baton Rouge, you know, it's just certain areas that are low that require it.
Is she looking, are others looking, that you know, to get some assistance from FEMA and the federal government, as happened in the aftermath of Katrina?
We applied. My wife's mother applied. Their family got flooded too. So we haven't heard anything from them. We were just kind of told to take pictures, document what you've done and things like that. But you have to, you know, gut the house because mold's going to set in and it'll just kind of take over.
Paul Champagne, once again in Baton Rouge. David Mitchell, back to you with the Advocate News in Ascension Parish. What about FEMA and the amount of assistance that people are going to be able to get, particularly when they weren't required to have flood insurance and consequently they didn't?
Yes. Well, FEMA is just starting to roll out right now. In Ascension, they haven't quite set the disaster recovery center yet, but I think the governor's office said middle of the week that 70,000 people already signed up for disaster assistance, and they're encouraging people to sign up whether or not to have insurance. I think the estimate, we had a story on this week, the estimate was something like, they looked back at Katrina and a couple others, it was like $30,000 is what you end up with. So the upshot of the story was it's probably not going to get you all the way there, you know. And so that's for someone like your caller, just the Baton Rouge gentleman and his mother, you know, they could be in a tough spot trying to find a way to make it all come back together, you know.
Let me go back to Paul Champagne. Excuse me for interrupting you, but what do you think, Paul? Would $30,000 do the job or not?
I heard it was going to be a lot less. It may be, you know, under $10,000.
And why do you think that is?
Just, you know, we've seen what other people have got. I know it's just the average was, you know, much lower for these other incidents or other storms.
So, David Mitchell, some of these people, as I understand it, lived through Katrina, and they're now homeless. What does that mean for the long run?
I can tell you from Katrina, there was a lot of mental health issues just from Katrina, you know. Dealing with that whole situation, it's just really hard to wrap your head around. Everything's gone. A lot of times all your neighbors, all their stuff is gone. Sometimes they've moved away, so you've lost all those connections. Family members have left. And so it's a real strain on people, and it's very, very hard to come back from. Sometimes it causes marital issues, issues within a family. You know, it's a real psychological burden that you have to overcome beyond the monetary situation. So having this hit again, we've had some people, you know, who moved up here from New Orleans and have stayed. You know, if they got hit again, I mean, that's a double whammy, you know.
Paul Champagne, right. Now back to you. Are people trying to help each other out?
Yes, we had a lot of relatives or cousins from in New Orleans area that came. It's hard to get help here because everyone else, you know, they got relatives or family that they've got to help out. So it's kind of difficult to get friends and a lot of them in the same situation.
You're concerned about getting enough money from the federal government. Have there been efforts, though, to move in and help out by other authorities there in Louisiana at the parish level or the state level?
I haven't seen anybody come out at all. Our areas weren't hit as bad. I mean, we only had a few feet, so I don't know if they're in other areas. You know, I see a lot of, you know, churches and a high school down the street from my parents, from my mom. They're giving out food and supplies and things like that.
Let me introduce Bob Hansen. He's a meteorologist and blogger at Wonderground. Wonderground.com. He's also author of The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. Good to have you on our show.
All right, great to be here. Thanks.
Now, tell us about this storm. It's not a hurricane. It's even though this is hurricane season, it's almost exactly 11 years since Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. What was this, and what's the nature of it, and how do you account for it?
There's a lot of question marks around that. You know, my co-blogger Jeff Masters has labeled it a tropical depression-like storm with tropical depression impacts, and that may not sound very impressive, but tropical depressions, actually the weaker side of the hurricane spectrum, actually can be some of the heaviest rainers. When Hurricane Allison struck, or rather Tropical Storm Allison, struck Texas in 2001, that was mainly a depression during most of its life, but it caused just catastrophic flooding in Houston. So these weaker, slow-moving systems can really cause trouble. This one actually developed over about a week's time. It was offshore briefly, but then for most of its life, the surface center was onshore. And so that meant that the Hurricane Center couldn't really give it a name or classify it as a tropical cyclone. So that was part of the problem, I think. You know, as one of your previous guests says, it didn't have a name, but it was a sprawling system, and the amount of moisture in the atmosphere with this storm was more than a lot of hurricanes have, so it's really not surprising that it actually dumped more rain than a lot of hurricanes do.
So did it just sort of hover over the land?
It moved very, very slowly. That was a big part of the problem. It kind of creeped west, where there was pretty heavy rain on the Florida Panhandle coast as well. And then it settled in over southern Louisiana and moved very, very slowly. Rain pivoted around the center of the storm. So it wasn't like a typical, you know, thunderstorm that lasts several hours. And folks in that part of the country are very accustomed to that. You get a little bit of flooding, you go on. In this case, it just rained and rained and rained. And unfortunately, you know, it's hard to be prepared for a 100 or 200 or 500 year event, and this definitely pushed into that range. Even though it was well warned, it's still hard to envision what's going to happen when it's not something you've ever seen before.
What about development? We heard that Paul Champagne's house was a little higher, at least, than his mother's house. Has the development of that area taken into account that things like this might happen?
In general, development is a big cofactor with flooding. We find that urban areas, I mean, Houston is a good example of that. When you build outward and cover what was once water-absorbing land with concrete, there's just less place for the water to go. So development is probably part of the picture, I would guess. There's so many factors, you know. There's been some subsidence when you get toward the Louisiana coastline that has affected that area. But this is a little bit inland, and I think that was part of the reason it didn't get as much national attention until things really got bad. You know, Baton Rouge is a metro area of 500,000 people, but I think it's in the shadow of New Orleans. So when people were hearing there was flooding in Baton Rouge, I think there was this kind of, oh, it always floods in Louisiana. And so kind of the gravity of the situation didn't hit. And that area has not historically had as much in the way of catastrophic flooding as areas near the coast. But when you get that much rain in that amount of time, it can happen. And we've seen it, especially the last two or three years. You know, Oklahoma, Texas had the wettest month on record in May of last year, several billion dollars of flood damage there. South Carolina, likewise, in October last year, several billion. So we really have to get accustomed to these systems don't need a name to be a catastrophic.
Bob Hansen again with WonderGround.com. Kevin Trenberth is Senior Scientist for the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
When we start hearing about 500-year events, as we have more and more often, and we hear the kind of thing that Bob Hansen just said, it's beginning to sound like global warming and climate change.
That's very much a factor. I'm disappointed that there hasn't been more discussion of that aspect. And, you know, the real thing is that the environment in which all of these storms occur has changed from what it used to be.
Describe how it has changed.
Well, firstly, you know, global warming refers to the increases in especially greenhouse gases, the heat-trapping gases such as carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. And so there's a human cause to those changes in the composition of the atmosphere. So that creates extra heat. And that heat goes somewhere. We can actually measure that or assess that imbalance at the top of the atmosphere. And so we know the planet is heating up. Most of that heat goes into the oceans. And so the oceans are quite a bit warmer than they used to be. And we can actually measure that. And sea level has therefore gone up. Sea level's gone up about 3 inches since we've had altimeters in space since 1992. And that's partly because of the expansion of the oceans and partly because of melting of ice on land, like Greenland and glaciers. And so this is the global warming aspect, and it means that the sea temperatures and the air above the ocean is warmer, and it's also moister. And the rule of thumb is that about the atmosphere holds about 4% more moisture for about a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And over the Gulf and out to the east of the Florida Panhandle and so on, the sea temperatures have been running about 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. And the moisture in the atmosphere has been about 15% above normal in general. And then this tropical depression comes in and concentrates that moisture so that the amount of moisture that was in the atmosphere was unheard of. It's just an incredible amount. And this is what fuels the storm.
We understand that in other states, Oklahoma, Texas, South Carolina, West Virginia, there has been deadly flooding, and there were deaths, of course, in this case as well. Over the past 15 months, are we then looking at something that's going to become more common?
I think that's already here, but it does move around, and it depends upon where the natural variability is enhancing the global warming signature. So, you know, I think you can only blame maybe half of this on global warming. The other half is because the ocean happens to be warm for other reasons as well. But this happens, and this is the very nature of climate and weather, that some places are warmer than normal and some places are cooler than normal. But where it's warmer than normal, it adds into the global warming signature, and those are the places that get affected.
Okay. So, excuse me for interrupting you, but we need to go to a break. We're going to do that. We'll come back, and we'll continue this conversation with all of our guests. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the particular areas where the devastation is most painful. In our talking point later, Uber and driverless cars in Pittsburgh. That's on To The Point from PRI.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point, talking today about the immense damage done by a storm that still has no name. It moved very slowly into southern Louisiana, but it's done as much damage as Superstorm Sandy or Katrina, or it's certainly in that order of magnitude. And we were hearing that there's going to be more to come. Jackie Patterson is director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Sure, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Tell us who you think are the people that are going to be hurt the most by this.
So everything from certainly folks who are of low income, communities of color tend to be typically hurt most, and women also, and then further on, undocumented folks, people with different immigration statuses. Are some of the examples of folks that we found to be disproportionately negatively impacted by these types of disasters.
Why is that? Is it because of where they live?
So it's different for the different groups. Certainly in terms of low-income communities and communities of color, often they're disproportionately located in floodplains. They often are the ones who have poor housing stock, so that impacts the extent of the damage. And then also in terms of being able to recover afterwards, less likely to have homeowners insurance in general, and then definitely less likely to have a flood clause. In this case, with the Baton Rouge situation, they say 1 in 8 homeowners in East Baton Rouge, which is most impacted, only 1 in 8 have homeowners have flood insurance as part of their homeowners insurance policies. And I would dare say if we break that down in terms of the people who are more vulnerable in terms of low-income people, communities, and people of color, that it would probably be even worse statistics.
Why women specifically?
Unfortunately, in the context of disasters, from disaster after disaster, there's a spike in violence against women in disaster contexts and afterwards. We saw that from the earthquake in Gujarat to Hurricane Katrina to even the BP oil drilling disaster. Police blotters at least doubled in terms of reports of domestic violence post-disaster.
Are these people likely to get assistance from FEMA, even if it's not enough to completely rebuild?
So this is the other thing, and this is why I brought up undocumented persons, people with incarceration histories and so forth, is that help-seeking behaviors, even the extent to which folks will actually interact with the system, is impacted by some of those vulnerability factors. But then some of these other groups, the low-income communities, communities of color to some extent, are often not necessarily able to access the system in the same way, because for African Americans, 50% of African Americans aren't homeowners, 25% of white Americans aren't homeowners, and some of the assistance is tied to being a homeowner. And so if you're a renter, there's often less assistance available for you. So some of those issues impact the extent to which you can be able to get help.
So you're director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. What does that do? What do you do? How do you help people?
Yeah, so one, we try to make these very types of systems more equitable. We actually are coming out with a document called Human and Civil Rights in Emergency Management. It's a monitoring tool that actually helps people who are engaged in the whole disaster continuum to know what to look for in terms of making sure the systems are most equitable in the context of disasters. We do that also in terms of right now I'm in Detroit where we're conducting a 2-day energy justice training where we're helping folks to be able to advocate to go back to their states. We're working with two people from 17 states in the Midwest and Plain states who will after this training go back to their states and advocate for better equity and justice in the energy system. So we look at various systems that disproportionately negatively impact communities of color and low-income communities and help frontline community groups to be able to advocate for more equitable measures and more equitable systems.
You've been listening to our program and what we've heard from our other guests. How do you think you could increase or help to create a more just situation in southern Louisiana?
Yeah, so for example, I mean, just looking at that flood insurance issue in specifically, we used to have, and I'm not exactly a guru on these things myself, so all of these systems I need to continue to learn as I try to advance equity in them. But we used to have, with the National Flood Insurance Program, there was a subsidy for flood insurance, so it made it easier for people to be able to access it. We need to figure out how we can get it so that it's not when a flood happens that people find out that they're not in any way covered in terms of flood insurance. So that's one thing we absolutely need to do in order to be able to protect people for long-term impacts. We also need to help folks understand what their risk is if they actually have homes in floodplains. When the flooding happened in 2011 in Tunica, this whole community had just bought these plots of land less than a year before, and then because they were low income, they were looking for a bargain, and these plots were less expensive, and that's because they were in a floodplain. And less than a year after they had bought those plots and built on them, they were all underwater. So how can we make sure that there is a duty to inform folks, and so the folks know what their risks are and they can plan accordingly? Those are some of the examples.
Jackie Patterson again, NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Bob Hansen, back to you, our meteorologist with Wendergrund.com. You were saying that development is, in fact, a cofactor in these situations. What are these people doing on floodplains?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't have a ready answer to that. In fact, there are tables that tell you how frequent a particular magnitude of rain should happen. So that's where we come up with the calculations that, for example, this is a 500-year rain event. Well, those tables generally are not adjusted to deal with the fact that the heaviest rains are, in fact, increasing, as Kevin Turnberth pointed out a little while ago. When it rains hard, it's tending to rain a little bit harder, and rainfall is getting focused in those big events. And that isn't yet really accounted for in terms of planning for what they call recurrence intervals or return periods. So that undoubtedly feeds into insurance. And I would back up your previous guest from the NAACP in that we have really kind of a jerry-rigged, fragmented national flood insurance system right now. The federal system is way underfunded, and the subsidies, as she pointed out, are underpublicized, and many people are not aware that they need flood insurance, or if they need it, where they can get it. So I really think we need some attention to this. It's a bit like an echo of the national health insurance situation, where we just haven't seen it as a true national problem.
Kevin Turnberth, back to you with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. You were telling us earlier that the environment has changed. This is a result in part of global warming. Do we then have to take very seriously the fact that these things are going to continue and begin to plan for them in a way that we haven't so far?
Oh, yes, indeed. And so what is happening, as Bob mentioned, is that 500-year events are becoming 70-year events, so 50-year events, and things like that. But it's not just the storms and the floods that matter. There's also the other side of the coin, which is where it's not raining, the droughts are more intense, and the risk of wildfires are greater. And so there's actually a link for global warming to what's going on in California and, you know, up in Fort McMurray in Canada and so on. And so this is what tends to happen, is we have a period where it's very wet, and then in between there's a drought and water shortages occur. And so managing water is one of the things which is very fragmented in many communities, in many states. The people who are responsible for the flood aspects are the different people who are responsible for protecting against drought and things like that.
So managing water, whether you've got enough or whether you don't have enough, either way.
Right. Yes, you need to try and take advantage of the times when you've got too much and store that water for the times when you won't have enough.
David Mitchell, let me go back to you, our first guest, reporter for The Advocate News in Baton Rouge. Do people feel that because this happened as slowly as it did, and the national press, it took a long time to catch on to what was happening, do people feel ignored?
Yeah, to an extent, I would say yes. I think it's starting to turn a little bit. I think there's definitely a feeling that Louisiana tends to get overlooked a bit, and this would be maybe another example of that. However, I also would say, particularly in the parish that I cover, nobody's worrying about that. they got too much going on, and they're not worrying about whether people are giving them love in the media. They're focused on fixing their house, you know, making sure everybody's safe, that type of thing. I went and visited with a family by boat Wednesday. They had more than a foot of water in their house, and they were trying to salvage what they could. And they knew they were pretty much losing everything, or most of all their furniture and anything that wasn't elevated. It was pretty emotional for them. But they were kind of pretty determined to go on, you know. So when people talk about we're not paying attention to Louisiana, I would tell you Louisianans would like your interest in attention, but they're going forward whether you're with them or not.
Well, now, your paper, though, said that President Obama, who, of course, is on vacation, ought to come down because Louisiana needs you now. I understand the governor has told the president not to come because he and all of his security requirements might get in the way.
Correct. Of course, I'm a reporter, not an editorial writer. So,
got it.
But, yes, we did make a pretty bold stand on that. And I think probably New Orleans was in the back of a lot of people's minds. The clock was ticking there as far as when Bush started getting heat and when Obama's, you know, not showing up either. So, you know, there's sort of this comparison going on in people's minds. And, you know, when the big boss shows up, it does matter, right? That does have an effect. You know, if only symbolically, I can tell you another era of my reporting a couple of years ago, we had something called the Bayou Corn Sinkhole. Giant sinkhole formed from an industrial accident. And the governor of our state didn't show up in the community for a year. And he got a lot of heat for that. That's former Governor Jindal, okay? And people really gave him heat, and the state government was responding the whole time. There were state agencies involved from almost day one, but he didn't show up. And it was very important to the people who live there to see the governor, even though they were dealing with state, you know, DNR and all these environmental agencies and whoever. They wanted to see the big guy because it matters. And so I think that's what that editorial is trying to communicate, is even though, you know, Homeland Security Director came in the other day, we've seen other people show up. Craig Fugate came fairly early. It matters when the president shows up, whoever it is.
Paul Champagne, let me go back to you, a resident of Baton Rouge. You're living on an island surrounded by water, at least for a while. A man whose mother lost her house and all the furniture that was in it and everything else. Do you think that the president ought to come down? Would you like to see him there?
I don't know if it makes a difference at this point. I mean, if he comes or not.
What about Donald Trump? He's there. He's handing out stuff from the back of a truck.
Hey, that's all you could ask for. You know, we just need help.
Is that going to get more people to vote for Donald Trump, or are they not thinking about the presidential election at the moment?
I don't think anybody here is watching any TV at this time.
So
everyone's busy, you know, trying to, you know, help out, do what they can, you know, help their neighbors out.
Let me go back to Kevin Trenberth, again with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Do you think that it's time for people to simply move out of these areas, not try to rebuild, but to locate elsewhere? That happened with a lot of people in New Orleans.
Yes, and it's happened along parts of the Mississippi, for instance, where they've had, 300-500-year floods in the last, 25 years. And I was disappointed to see that they allowed people back in a number of areas in New Orleans where they're quite vulnerable for the next tropical storm that comes along. So, you know, there are other places around the world, Pacific Islands, that are suffering from rising in sea level where people are evacuating, or on the north coast of Alaska and places like that. So that's a real consideration that ought to be come into play.
And you made the connection with the fires as a result of the drought in California. That's often said that people are simply living too close to the edge and that they ought not to do that.
Yes, but of course it's not just in the U.S. I mean, the flooding that's occurred in China, for instance, in recent times, and also actually in Europe, in Germany and France in May and June, has been very extensive. So it's not just in Louisiana either.
Jackie Patterson, back to you with the NAACP. What about the people who can't afford to move? Is that a problem, or is this an invitation to a lot of people, particularly poor people and people of color, to move someplace else?
So it is interesting because I don't know if you heard, but the New York Times had a front page article about this group of 35 folks, I think it was, from the Pointe-aux-Chiens tribe in Ile-de-Jean-Charles in in Louisiana who were moved because their land was actively being overtaken due to sea level rise, and they were the first ever group of folks who were moved under federal funding because they were in danger of being impacted by sea level rise. And so it's already starting to happen, and we know in places like Thibodaux, Louisiana, they're losing a football field size land mass every day due to the combination of sea level rise and the fact that their land is sinking because of offshore oil drilling. So, as we said, it's definitely an active threat, and it's a conversation because in certain groups, particularly with indigenous groups and others, there's kind of cultural ties to the land, and so it's not just a matter of moving from one place to another. There's whole community processes that need to happen. So, yes, certainly there's conversations now about, you know, what it looks like to get people out of harm's way, because that's a reality. But it's also, this is one of the things we are actively working on, is how to make sure that those processes happen in a way that it's not something that happens to people, but they're actually community-led processes, community-involved in decision-making.
Paul Champagne, back to you. Do you think that a lot of people will, as a result of this, once they hear the kind of thing that we've been hearing on this program, decide to move away?
No, I think everyone's going to stay where they're at. I mean, they've been there for forever. Mom's been in her house for 40 years. The whole street's been there. We never had any flood, anything close to this. I mean, even in Ascension Parish and Livingston, it's never been this bad.
We're hearing, though, that it's going to be this bad. It's going to continue.
Yeah, but I think it's just a freak storm that happens. I mean, it was a lot of rain for such a short period of time. And I think it's just going to happen every now and then. It's just something. It's part of nature.
Okay, we're going to leave it that. Leave it at that. Paul Champagne again, a resident of Baton Rouge, not to himself badly hurt by the flood, although his mother and others certainly were. David Mitchell with the Advocate News. Thanks to you, Bob Hansen with Wonderground.com, Kevin Trenberth at the National Center for Atmosphere Research, and Jackie Patterson with the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Thank you all. Uber getting a jump on a new industry, self-driving cars. Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. Google and Apple and Tesla and Ford are all working on driverless cars. General Motors says it'll be in on the action, along with automakers in Germany and Japan. The consensus is they won't be actually on the streets until 2021. But now, Uber is offering a Volvo, modified to be automatic, for customers in downtown Pittsburgh. Martial Hebert, is director of the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why are they doing this in downtown Pittsburgh?
Well, first of all, Pittsburgh has an outstanding environment for developing this technology. Carnegie Mellon in particular has been working on autonomous system for over 30 years. So there is a wealth of expertise and knowledge in the region for this technology. As far as Uber, one of the issues in self-driving car is how to transfer this technology to the public and how to have the public use that technology in a safe manner. The ride-sharing model that Uber has provides this an opportunity to exercise the technology with real people, yet safely with safety drivers and supervisory drivers.
I think it's very important to point out that there will be a human being at the wheel just in case. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And again, that's an important feature of this experiment because it has both features, basically, the state-of-the-art technology, driverless technology, but at the same time, the safety that goes with the supervisory driver. And by conducting this experiment, Uber, and by extension, the entire industry, can gain experience with this technology, and including experience from the users, from real users, from the general population.
Well, ultimately, I presume Uber hopes to eliminate its human drivers, and they won't have to then pay and have health insurance and all the other things that employees require. Do you think that's the major goal of Uber?
Well, they have to speak for their own long-term strategy, but certainly self-driving eventually would not require necessarily supervisory driver. But for this initial stage, it is important to have supervisory driver for the obvious safety reasons.
Apparently, Uber hires or has employed roughly 1 million drivers, so we're talking about a lot of jobs. How long do you think it'll be before all of us can drive cars that don't have without putting our hands on the wheel or the brake or needing letting the robots take over, I guess is the best way to put it?
Well, it depends on the level of autonomy. There are already systems that have automatic braking and lane control and things like that. So it really depends on the level of autonomy. As far as full autonomy, full self-driving, it's at this point, I believe, still very hard to predict exactly how long that would take.
You said one of the reasons that this is being done in Pittsburgh is that your university, Carnegie Mellon, has a lot of people there who are expert in this technology. Are they being hired away, not just by Uber, but by others as well?
We have, of course, people who are hired to work in this in those companies, including the Uber Tech Center. But this is something, in a way, that we proud of, after all, to be one of the major centers of development for this technology. As I said, for the past 30 years.
You pointed out that one of the desirable things about this is that Uber will be able to get people familiar with this technology, and that will be very helpful in developing it and preparing people for it. Are they going to share that information, do you know, with the automakers? They don't intend to go into the car, the making of automatic cars, do they?
Well, again, Uber should speak for their strategy. I don't know their detailed long-term strategy, but as far as I know, they are not in the business of building the cars, but more in the business of using the autonomy effectively, the self-driving features effectively.
Would you feel safe now if you had an Uber app on your smartphone? Would you be willing to ride in a driverless car, presuming that there will be a professional along with you?
Well, I'm going to do that very soon. Yes, of course, being in Pittsburgh.
So how soon do you think it'll be a reality on the streets of Pittsburgh?
Well, in terms of, did you mean without the supervisor driver?
No, with the supervisor. It hasn't started yet, has it?
It will start very soon, and as soon as it starts, I will certainly use it, yes.
Why Volvo? How is it when we hear about Tesla and Google and others that are supposed to be so advanced, all of a sudden along comes Volvo? How well along is that company in providing these cars?
Well, the more important point there is that traditional, by lack of a better term, traditional car manufacturers have tremendous expertise on everything that goes around the self-driving features, in other words, the car itself. And that is an important consideration. And so instead of starting from scratch on a different trajectory as far as the car design is concerned, this approach is more looking at using existing highly experienced car manufacturer to bring to bear their expertise.
How intense do you think is the competition now with Uber getting into the game between Elon Musk with Tesla and with Google and others who have invested so much in this technology?
Oh, it certainly is very intense. And in fact, with this announcement, it's certainly going to intensify. It is, in fact, guaranteed to intensify instantly because of this announcement, I would believe. Yeah.
How serious is the safety issue, and is it going to be resolved anytime soon? There was a driverless Google car that crashed and killed a driver just a few months ago, and what's it going to take for consumers to actually trust it?
Well, that is certainly a central issue in the deployment of self-driving car, and this is why this experiment is particularly interesting, because the ride-sharing approach that Uber uses potentially can enable acquiring an enormous amount of experience with the technology. And with this amount of experience comes a more reliable system, better design, and also building trust of the users. So in that sense, it's particularly important for the safety aspects and the trust and the future deployment.
I misspoke a moment ago. It was a Tesla car, not a Google car, in which somebody died. How is this working in downtown Pittsburgh? Are you the only one that intends to go out and flag one down or order one up with the app, or is it already creating excitement?
Oh, I'm sure many people are looking forward to using that that system. I did not take a, you know, statistical tour, but I'm sure many people are intrigued and excited by the possibility of trying that service. Yes.
Well, obviously, you talk to your friends at Carnegie Mellon, and I presume a lot of them who are involved in this technology are going to try it out.
Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, again, this is a very important event for us at Carnegie Mellon. As I said already, we've been working for over 30 years in this general area of autonomy, okay, and giving intelligence to machines, and seeing that technology being deployed, even if it's the early stages, even if there is a safety driver and all the caveats that we mentioned, it is a major achievement. To see all this work being materialized, being transferred to the real world like this. Okay, so I think everybody is very excited about that.
Martial Hébert, again, director of the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To the Point, produced this week by Tina Rubio, Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Jenny Hamill, Gideon Brower, and Paul von Zielbauer. Our technical directors, Mike Newport and Joel Stein. Managing producer, Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.